All right, everybody, let's have an AA meeting. My name is Julie, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story.
Hey, my name's Terry. I'm an alcoholic. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our own personal stories describe in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their life. We hope that no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listen later on aabluechipspeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. We believe that this is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Now to introduce the speaker. I am privileged and honored to be able to introduce our speaker tonight, Amy C. There are so many good things that I could say about this woman. She's touched many lives. I know that she's touched mine. She's very inspiring to a lot of women and helps us believe in ourselves more today than yesterday. Here comes Amy.
I'm Amy. I'm an alcoholic. If my voice is shaky for a little bit, I hope that it will settle. My sobriety date is January 24th, 2013. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor. I have a sponsee. I have a home group, a solution group in Snellville. I'm slightly biased. I think it is the best home group. But I'm going to tell you guys what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And thank you, Terry, for asking me to do this. When she first asked me, she texted me, and I said, let me think about it. And I just talked to my sponsor prior, so I thought, you know, immediately I responded, because I knew if I called my sponsor, she would say, no, you have to be of service. So I just responded with, of course, I'll do it. So thank you. I appreciate it. So I am from a very small town in South Georgia. We have one red light. We're home of the Big Pig Jig. It's very country and rural. I grew up in an alcoholic home. My dad is still an active alcoholic. I have two older brothers, and my parents are recently divorced since I've been sober. Growing up, I went to a very small private school. I was happy. I was a part of. I was in clubs and cheered. I think I was good. I don't know that I felt like I was different until at some point, probably in middle school, I thought that, you know, I would ask if I could have people spend the night. My mom would say, well, you know, your dad's going to be home this weekend. And because he's an alcoholic, as we know that, you know, his behavior was unpredictable. So I think that's when I started feeling different, you know, that was, you know, affecting my life. My dad, he worked out of town, so he was absent a lot of the time. My mom pretty much raised us. So growing up, other than that, you know, that was what made me feel different, I guess. When I was 14, I had my first drunk. It was at a bonfire. I blacked out. I was, like, put in the shower. You know, I threw up. I was singing Foreigner. I want to know what love is. If you're curious, I remember that much. That was my first drunk. It was Mr. Boston's vodka. Nothing, you know, nothing fancy or expensive. Throughout then, when I went to high school, I mean, I really started, and I did some other outside issues that I won't talk about, but that really, alcohol was, you know, I'm an alcoholic to the core. That starts it for me. I did more than dabble in other stuff throughout my high school. It started where it would just be on the weekends. I would say ninth grade, it was pretty regular every weekend. I liked being center of attention. I liked having fun. I mean, I really wanted to be up and happy all the time and have fun. I mean, that was kind of like what I wanted to do. And throughout high school, I think because I had the structure, I was able to still maintain really good grades. Now, my junior year of high school, my school started doing drug tests. And, you know, not until I got sober looking back, you know, and I do a first step, do I realize that even at that age, at 17, when I had everything to lose, you know, I ended up being salutatorian in my school, but I had everything to lose. So I think a normal person at that point would say, okay, this is not worth it, you know, my future and my life. And even with that, I was still unable to stop and ended up failing a drug test at school. And, you know, I would have to test every month, and then I failed again. And somehow we talked the board into letting me stay, and they voted. But even then, I was unable to stop at 17 and 18. So I graduate high school. I go to the University of Georgia. I did not graduate. I remember when I left, when I was getting ready to go off to college, when I chose the college that I wanted to go to, I thought I'll be free from like my mom's rules or having to tell people, you know, where I was going when I left the house. I could do whatever I wanted. And that's what I did. And I didn't go to school. After about 2.5 years, I flunked out of Georgia. During that time, I guess I was 20 when I had, So during that time, my freshman year of college, I had an uncle die of cirrhosis of the liver. My grandfather died, and because of my own addiction, he had 20 years sober the day he died. Now, because of my own addiction, I was unable to be there. You know, my mom had called and said, okay, they're calling in the family, and I got there after he had passed. I just couldn't show up, you know, and that was no different than being able to show up for class or, you know, Thanksgiving, those kind of things. I had an abortion when I was 18. So numerous things that my disease caused me, that came first before anything else in my life. I had the DEA come in my apartment at college when I was 19. So lots of terrible scenarios. I'll give you an example. I think about this, and I've shared it in a meeting. I remember being 21, and this is kind of like a good snapshot that I have, you know, that, okay, alcoholic. I was 21, and I was sitting at home, and I had two weddings to go to that weekend in my hometown that my brothers were going to be in. And I thought, well, I'm just going to have a couple beers at the apartment, you know. I'm going to stay in tonight because I have to go home tomorrow. You know, and then I have these friends call, and they're like, hey, let's go downtown. And I thought, oh, I really need to stay in, but okay. And what happens when I put that first drink in me, you know, later on that night, I end up, you know, in a blackout, in jail, hungover, throwing up. I have no idea what I've been arrested for. And when my mom bailed me out, I had to get, we had to go get the police report to find out. That's what my drinking led to. It's just, I had no idea, you know, what line I would cross that night. And just to kind of qualify, I've been to jail 6 times in 4 different counties. From various things, from bad checks to drug charges and stuff like that. During this time, I lived in Athens for 7 years, and throughout that time, I went to Georgia for 2.5 years, never went to school. I went to Athens Tech for maybe a year. I went to, I don't even know school anymore, anyway, it's in Watkinsville, the Watkinsville campus. Gainesville State? Is that what it is? Maybe. And that's terrible. I went there for like maybe 2 years. I can't remember the name of the school. So went to 3 schools. You know, I would work 6-month jobs, you know, telemarketing, kind of a little sales stuff. That was kind of what I did. You know, called out once a week, never went to class, would attempt to try to go to the exams, but, you know, I would oversleep. So just incapable of showing up for stuff, which is, you know, at some point in my life, I said, you know, I think probably when I was probably in high school, and things that my dad did, and I thought, you know, I never want to be like him. And that's who I was. That's who I am. So within that 7 years, that's kind of what's going on now. I am manipulating my mom to send me money for whatever reason. If it's to find a guy, if it's to get groceries, whatever it is, to get money so that I can drink. You know, I'm writing her bad checks, my bad checks. So in November of 2010, my mom, she came to bail me out of jail and said, okay, you're moving home. It was Thanksgiving. So within that last 6 months, I'm living with my mom, and, you know, she thinks, okay, if she can have me at home, that I'll be okay. She's a really good enabler. She can fix me. And so within that 6 months, my disease just really, it got worse. And, you know, throughout my addiction, I said, you know, I mean, I compared myself to other people so that I would feel superior, or, you know, to keep me in denial. So I said, well, you know, I'll never do that, or at least I don't do that. You know, and so I was in denial that how bad it was. And throughout the years, I crossed those lines every time. So there's not much I haven't done. So when I was in that 6 months, I am writing thousands of dollars of check on my mom. I'm disappearing for like 2 weeks at a time, so I won't answer the phone. And she finally, she's like, okay, you know, let's just get you in a place. Now, at this point, like, I know that my life is very unmanageable, and I'm 26, so I'm thinking I can't keep living this way. You know, I see people my age that are like married and have families, and, you know, I realized that, you know, I still want these things in my life. So I said, okay, you know, I'm sorry, I didn't say that. She came and got me from this guy's house, and she had a baseball bat, and it wasn't just like, okay, I'll go to rehab. No, my mom had to literally come, like, find me from this person's house, take me home. I'm like, I'm not going, and I had pawned my laptop, and I was like, well, I won't go without my music, you know, just very entitled, so it wasn't all, like, just easy. But when she gets me to detox, you know, I was in detox for 6 days, and I went to a treatment center called Mar in Lawrenceville, and I was really depressed about, you know, it was going to be 90 days, and it was summertime, and I thought, I'm going to miss the summer, and, but once I get there, and Mar changed my life. I mean, that rehab center changed my life, and it set the foundation for me for recovery. And it was my first experience with AA. And I'll tell you that the first AA meeting that I ever went to, it was like taking it was just like taking a breath of fresh air, because for the first time, I mean, I think that I'm this horrible person. I've done terrible things to everybody in my life that means anything to me. And you guys are sharing about that, about those same things. And I thought that I was all alone. So that was refreshing for me. I thought, okay, this is good. And I would love to tell you that that was my original sobriety day, but it's not. I got sober for the first time May 2011. And I was in rehab, and my life was unmanageable. I couldn't get a job. You know, I had nothing going for me, no money, nothing. So in rehab, you know, I started working the steps. I got a sponsor. I got a home group, all the things that you talk about, with, you know, that we need to do. And I stayed in treatment. I went to their three-quarter program. And during that time, I got a job with a company. This is a sales job, selling timeshare. And I still work for that company today. Well, so I started as a sales rep. I thought I was unhireable. I got a job. So all these things that I did through, you know, because I got sober, all these promises started to come true. So during that time that I'm there, I got offered a management position to move to Macon, which I took. So I moved to Macon. I had I had 14 months sober. I really remember exactly the day that I relapsed. It was July 14th. But, okay, so what happened? I moved to Macon when I was 9 months sober. And I went to meetings for a little bit. I got a sponsor for a little bit. And I slowly let go of those things. I put other things in front of my recovery. I made my life about work and money. And, you know, success can be just as much a trigger as failure for me. So I stopped going to meetings. I stopped working with a sponsor. I stopped praying. And I started talking to my ex, which are all relapse triggers. So when I start talking to my ex and I finally say, yes, come over, this will be great. He just got out of rehab. But I was sick. I was still really, really sick. You know, obviously, I'm not in the meetings to hear you guys talk about, you know, the maintenance that I have to do to stay sober. So I forget about, you know, how bad it was. And so July 14th, I picked up. I remember for 3 hours the battle in my head about doing it. And I know in the big book it talks about, like, you know, oh, I just, you know, accidentally drank. I can't relate to that. I literally processed and, like, had, you know, the committee in my head going back and forth of, like, well, I really thought that I was enough. I knew that I couldn't drink successfully, but I didn't have a defense against the first drink at that point. Because it was just myself. So for 3 hours, I battled this idea of drinking or not drinking. And finally, when I came to the conclusion, I said, well, I will pick up a white chip tomorrow. But because I'm not in the meeting, I forgot that once I put the drink in my system, that the craving sets in and the obsession sets in. And that's what happened to me. I could no longer, I had the shame and the guilt, like, immediately for like a week. But I couldn't think about anything else but drinking. And that was stronger than anything else. And my relapse lasted 7 months. And it was as bad as you guys say it is. That, you know, it's a progressive disease, and it is that bad. And during that time, I cut everybody out of my life that was in the program that occasionally I talked to. I was lying to my parents. I'm sorry, I need to say this. So in my relapse, I got promoted to a bigger store and moved back to Gwinnett, which is where I got sober. And so I'm thinking, I got this. I can drink and I can be successful. And so that really kept me in my disease, I think, for that time. And, you know, looking back now, I didn't know this, but for me, I think, you know, the first step says we're powerless over alcohol, our life is unmanageable. I knew my life was unmanageable, and I didn't think that I could drink successfully, but I don't know that I had convinced myself that I was powerless over alcohol until my relapse. So, I like to tell people that you only have to pick up one white chip, but for me, I'm grateful for my relapse because it smashed the idea that I could drink like other alcoholics. I mean, like, yeah. I could probably drink like y'all. So I'm going to tell you, like, the what happened on this part, because this is what, you know, this was my rock bottom for me. So in December of 2012, yes, December, thank you. In December of 2012, I had gone to my therapist. I'm lying to everybody. If I saw a person in the program, I'd say, oh, it's been about 2 weeks, you know, which has been like an hour since I've drank. But in December, I went to see my therapist, and I thought, you know, this is somebody. I needed to tell somebody what was going on with me because I was lying to everyone else. And, you know, I went in there, and she said, I said, I think that I can control it. And my cell phone had been cut off, and my lights had been, I mean, so I was kind of crazy, like I had it going, but my car was about to get repo. I mean, it was bad. So, but I said, I think I can control it. She said, why are you here? And I said, because I'm lonely and miserable. And I told her that January 1st, that was going to be my New Year's resolution, that I was going to quit drinking. And she said, your disease is going to really progress because you're giving yourself a timeline. And that's what happened. And I want to read this to you. I'm going to try not to cry for this. But in a vision for you, it says he cannot picture life without alcohol. Someday he will be unable to imagine life either with alcohol or without it. Then he will know loneliness such as few do. He will be at the jumping off place. He will wish for the end. And what happened to me was a couple days before New Year's Eve, I had gone, I went to the bar with this guy. We were going to have dinner, a couple beers as usual. I end up blacking out that night when I get home. And in a blackout, I do some outside substances. And I'll tell you this because of what happened. So I waited a few days and I end up in the hospital. And I had a serious infection in my arm. And I had waited about 6 days before I even went. And then I was really scared because I was sick and throwing up. And so I go to the hospital by myself. No one knows. And they admit me to the hospital, and I have to they have to put me to sleep to have surgery, which is the first time that I had experienced anything like that, to be put to sleep. And I was afraid that I was going to die alone, which is, that's rock bottom for me. And that was the first time, you know, the first time I got sober, it was because my mom pushed me to rehab. And this time it was because I was afraid of dying. You know, I was 27, 28, I guess. So from that point on, I was in the hospital for 6 days, and my sobriety date is January 24th because I was on pain medication from the surgery on my arm. So I waited. That's when I made my sobriety date. But I immediately started going to 90 and 90. And my friend came to my house. I mean, I had to pick IV and just, you know, it was bad. And she said, are you done? You know, you still have your job. You still have your family. You still have your home, your car. But that was the loneliest place. It was the darkest time in my life, and I never want to experience that again. The baffling part of this disease to me is that, you know, I have this terrible scar on my arm. As lonely and dark as that place is, I can forget that, you know. And I know that from my previous relapses, that if I stop coming to meetings, if I stop talking to people in the program, working the steps, you know, if I stop doing the things that keep me sober, I can go back to that with all that I've been through. And that's crazy. So, you know, what my life's like today, we may get out early, I don't know. So this time around, immediately, you know, I never finished the steps the first time. I got to the eighth step and stopped. So this time around, I got a sponsor, and I was hesitant to write. One, because I hate to write. I'm just lazy in nature, I think, with that. But so I started writing. I had women in the program. I'm going to a meeting every day. I have people that will come over and sit with me just so I could do my writing to keep me focused. You know, I worked the 12 steps for the first time. You know, I made amends for the first time, which was life-changing. I mean, that's, you know, I can, you know, we all know, like in my family or the people that I've harmed, we all know what I did. It's no secret, you know. But admitting to them, my grandmother kind of hit it on the head for me. When I made amends to my grandmother, you know, she said that you've never apologized for anything that you did. Like, that was the first time that I had ever admitted and apologized for the things that I had done wrong. And that was it. I always tried to skim out of it and just, like, you know, it's happened, it's over, let's move on. And I was taking ownership for my actions, and that was a first. You know, I continued to, I joined a solution group within that first year, and getting connected there. I mean, I have about 10 people from solution group that came here to see me tonight. And that is, it's not, well, my birthday was yesterday, but it's not my birthday or anything. But you know, they came here to support me. And that means everything to me. That's the kind of love that I have. And I know that if I don't show up on my Monday and Thursday meeting, that I'll get a phone call. you know, I started working with a new sponsor in February, and I continue to grow. You know, the first time I got sober, I think that my relationship with God was very, or my prayer and my relationship with God. I think it was, I would say that my prayers were very ritual, like, you know, I did the third step prayer or said the serenity prayer, but it was kind of like checking it off a list. And, you know, the way that my relationship is with God today is that I turn to God for everything. You know, like I'm nervous before the meeting, I pray for God to calm my nerves. You know, so the women in my life that I lean on, I wouldn't be able to stay sober. So that's another part of the difference between, you know, the first time I got sober and now is that, you know, I'm connected. I have this huge women, you know, network of women, you know, that love me and support me and walk with me through my journey, and I can reach out to. And I can tell him the craziest shit that's going on. That's the first time I cussed, by the way. He ain't back there. Sorry. But just the crazy stuff that's going on in my head. And it's okay. And it's some sick stuff sometimes. But, I'll tell you, that, you know, I have two more things to say, I think, and then I'm done. So another thing, like the promises that come true. I kept my job through all this. I love my job. It's stressful and sometimes I hate it, but it fits me and I'm good at it. And, you know, but I got in a relationship with a guy that's in the program 3 years ago, almost four years ago. And we just got engaged in September. Now, I think I'm awesome. So I do. I think I'm awesome. However, I also can like get, you know, in doubt and listen to these voices in my head that I'm not good enough, that I'm not the Marian type, whatever it is. So all that stuff that we, you know, stuff that we struggle with just because we have these inner voices. And you know, not that I get my validation from the women in my life and God, but somebody loves me enough to spend the rest of their life with me. And that's cool, you know, and I get to do that in sobriety. And nobody, that would have never happened to me if I was still in my addiction. So the other thing I want to tell y'all is this cool thing that just happened and just how different my life is. So my best friend gave me this... for my birthday yesterday, she gave me this. It's a jar, and it's 365 note jar. And it has this key on it. It's different things like why your friends love you, why we're best friends, future, memories, words of encouragement. And she took the time to reach out to other of my friends. You know, she wrote 365 things down. And ever for one day a year, one day for an entire year, I will open a note. And I can promise you, so I've only opened three, but I can assure you that in that jar, it's not going to say that you're a selfish drunk, you're a sociopath, you don't care about people. And that's what people said about me 4 years ago. You know, and that's the difference between my life today and my life then. You know, that people love me, people care about me, and for the next year, I get to read that stuff, which is awesome. So I appreciate you guys asking me to do this. And thank you.
Wow, that was great. I'm sitting here thinking about how she just closed that up with how she found love and for herself and for other people in the room. And there she was singing that song all those years ago. I want to know what love is. I want you to show me. And AA showed you. And I think that's pretty dang cool. I've asked Kat to give out tips, please.
Hey y'all, I'm Kat. I'm an alcoholic. Great story. I enjoyed it. There's a lot in there that I could totally relate.
First I slip and then I crib to a hope-filled dream. You rescue me and finally wake and there I see. I look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promises are real. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, stride for stride, we walk eternally. Look into love's window for a heart that beats for me. Takes me where the promises are real. And I always long for something to set me free. Where the promises are.